Chapter 5. Madness. Madness. He had no notion of the passage of time, no idea where they were, no thought any longer of where they might be going, and hardly a care for any of it.
"I can see nothing,"
he whispered harshly to his halfling companion. At least he hoped he was whispering to his halfling companion. He couldn't see his own hand if he'd held it up to his face, let alone Regis.
"We've no choice,"
Regis whispered back, much more quietly.
"They are behind us. We cannot turn back. The only way is ahead, through the orc patrol."
"I'm as likely to hit you as one of them,"
Wulfgar warned. Regis's sigh was not one of disagreement. He took Wulfgar's hand and put it atop his head, a head that was no longer adorned with the fabulous beret.
"Just keep your swings higher than that,"
the halfling quipped. But Wulfgar wasn't laughing. They had come to the end of the line, he believed, and indeed almost hoped. When they'd ventured out to the east of Mithril Hall, they'd been forced lower, and now into regions where the illuminating lichen was sparse and the darkness near total. Even Regis, possessed of superior low-light vision, could barely navigate the tunnels. For poor Wulfgar, there was only eternal night.
"No," he decided. "I'll swing every which way. How many do you say? 5?
"At least. Perhaps 6 or 7.
"I go alone,"
Wulfgar said.
"They'll kill you."
"The way will be clear for you, I promise," said Wulfgar.
"No," Regis started to argue, but Wulfgar cut him short.
"I'm only slowing you down," the barbarian said. "I can see nothing. How many times have I cracked my thick skull on these unyielding stones already? Better that you go on alone."
"You're talking foolishness,"
the halfling said with a growl.
"Foolishness would be for both of us to die out of a misplaced sense of valor."
"Friendship, not valor,"
Regis corrected.
"And never misplaced."
Wulfgar thought it over for a few moments, then conceded the point.
"I, my friend, and I would argue as you do now if our places were reversed, but they are not. You can find your way out of here, particularly with this hat you have so mastered, and with your understanding of our enemy's ways and language. You can escape, but I cannot."
"We don't know that."
"And you have reason to escape," said Wulfgar. "How many times have you told me of beautiful Denala? Find your way out. Find your way back to her. Tell her of me."
"Of course," said Regis. "I will introduce..."
"Wulfgar is a fine name for a halfling child, I think," the barbarian interrupted.
Despite himself, Regis couldn't help but chuckle at that. But if Wulfgar thought him convinced, the notion was dispelled a moment later.
"We are the companions of the hall," Regis insisted. "We fight as one and die as one, if that is what the fates decide."
"The fates," Wulfgar said with a laugh. "The fickle fates granted me this second life. It is all borrowed time, and now I repay that debt. Fear not, my friend, for I am not afraid, surely not. I go where I should already be, where my wife and children reside."
"End," Wulfgar said, putting on the beret Regis had just given to him.
"You do not know that they will win. Where is your faith in your friend?"
He gurgled as he finished, as his features and body altered from that of a large human to an ogrelon.
"Lead me as far as you safely can,"
Wulfgar bade the halfling. And he extended his hand, which Regis took in his own. They started slowly along the tunnel. There were no side tunnels or forks, but still the going was very slow, Wolfgar's every blind step hesitant. They neared a bend in the corridor, and a smell assaulted them. The orc patrol was just up ahead, in a wider stretch of corridor.
Karak,
Regis whispered to his friend.
What?
Karak. The orc word for torch, Regis explained. Call for it when you come upon them.
Karak?
You'll have a better chance than if you're simply flailing in the darkness, whispered Regis, his voice going very quiet.
He dropped Wolfgar's hand then.
Stay low. Perhaps 100 steps ahead. But there are rocky overhangs.
I smell them, Wolfgar assured him.
And he started off, bending low as Regis had advised, and keeping the head of Aegis Fang out in front of himself. A few moments later, he heard shuffling, faintly but distinctly, from ahead.
Garek!
He called to the orcs. They called back to him, a line of gibberish he couldn't begin to decipher.
Garek!
He said again, more forcefully, and he kept moving, faster now. More gibberish assailed him, and something, an arrow, he thought, skipped off the wall beside him. Wolfgar lowered his voice to ominous, rumbling tones and demanded,
Garak!
He heard muttering up ahead, growing louder. He brushed his head on a low overhang and winced, the painful memories of too many such collisions still clear in his thoughts. He could see nothing, but sensed that he had come through some entrance, like an archway framing a room. It felt airier suddenly, as if he had moved into a wide and hopefully high-ceilinged area. An orc yapped at him from just a couple of strides ahead, and there were others all around him, he sensed. And for a moment, he thought to take up his warhammer and begin his frenzied assault. But instead, he said once more,
Garak!
Then came some mumbling, and Wolfgar expected a spear to drive into him at any moment. He was relieved indeed when instead he heard the scrape of steel on flint, and a quick shower of sparks briefly illuminated the area, enough for Wolfgar to see the half-dozen orcs before and to either side of him, those nearest with spears leveled for him. The sparks spit into the darkness again, and Wolfgar clenched his warhammer tight. His magical disguise wasn't likely very good, and the revealing light of the torch would surely give him away. But he'd get the first hit. The torch flared to life. Wolfgar was wrong. He didn't strike first. Not far from the battle scene, on the southwestern edges of the Glimmerwood, Cynophane gathered with her companions. They had heard the fighting, but didn't have sufficient strength to engage the massive enemy force. Scouts had gone forth, however, and had returned with details of the thousands of dead, mostly orcs.
They tried to break out against great odds, Cynophane remarked to Muriel,
when the young elf female had returned from the blasted area around the rune gate.
Many dwarves among the bodies,
Muriel replied solemnly.
It was a costly attempt, my lady. A desperate attempt,
Cynophane corrected.
They need to break the siege. They are safe in their citadel, replied Muriel. We have no reports of the orcs even trying to break into Felbar, or of any massing of forces that could attempt such a thing.
Above ground, said Cynophane. We do not know what is happening below the surface. All we know is that King Emerus came forth with most of his legions, and against an enemy force that still greatly outnumbered his own. That he would do such a thing in midwinter, indeed in a blizzard.
The blizzard was tactical cover,
another younger elf, Domgarden, put in.
It would seem that Felbar used the storm as cover to gain surprise on the orcs, and it worked, judging by the destruction at the eastern end of the orc encampment.
And what would King Emerus have gained if his plan had worked, and he had chased the orcs away from this exit?
The Lady of the Moonwood asked.
He would have broken the siege, answered Muriel. Temporarily only, said Cynophane.
There are many more orcs. A much larger gathering at Felbar's more common gates, not far to the south of here. And another sizable force across the Cerberon, besieging Mithril Hall.
The other two elves looked to each other for an answer.
Perhaps he meant to go to Mithril Hall and enable a greater breakout there,
Muriel offered at length.
In that blizzard?
Cynophane asked doubtfully.
By the time they reached the river through the piling snow, word of their breakout would have spread to all the orc forces, and the dwarves would then be fighting with fingers blackened by the cold. Then why?
Asked Muriel.
For the orcs' food,
Dom Garten said suddenly, the revelation coming to him. He looked at Cynophane and nodded, as if it was all coming clear to him.
They came out not to break the siege, but to raid the orc encampment. They came out for supplies. They are hungry,
Cynophane agreed.
They are desperate. First Mithril Hall and now Felbar,
Muriel lamented.
It would seem as if our dwarf neighbors are no better off than any other kingdoms of Lorwar.
What can we do, lady? Dom Garten asked.
The dwarves will try again,
Cynophane replied.
It would seem as if they have no choice in the matter. We cannot help them in their holes, but perhaps we can soften their enemies should they come out again.
She turned to her two trusted scouts.
Go and find as many as you can collect, and bring them to me in this place. Perhaps we near the time when we of the Moonwood stop simply surviving and begin taking some actions that will help restore the lands to proper form.
The two nodded, bowed, and ran off, leaving Cynophane alone. She went quickly to a nearby tree and moved up its branches as gracefully as a squirrel, coming to sit on a limb some 30 feet up from the ground, which afforded her a grand view of the Rovens and of the orc encampment between the forest and the mountains. She considered the plight of her people, and how they were no doubt much better off than their human and dwarf neighbors. The elves of the Moonwood had no real home, unless the whole of the Glimmerwood could count as such. Their mobility was their freedom. The orcs could not catch them in an underground citadel or a walled city, could not catch them and could not count them, and could never quite be sure of how many might come against any raiding parties they sent into the forest at any given time. Even if Silvery Moon fell, and all three dwarven citadels beside her, Cynophane's clan would survive. Right in the heart of a new and vast orc kingdom, they could survive. But it was not a life Cynophane desired. She had many friends in Silvery Moon. Indeed, many of her people had close kin in that city, which was heavily flavored by elven traditions and architecture. And even among the dwarves, Cynophane counted many friends. Mithril Hall had once been very closely allied to the Moonwood. Drisdo Erden, friend to King Brunner, had fought beside in Ovendil and Tarathiel, two leaders of the elf clan and two of Cynophane's dearest friends. Their heroics, battling the original King Obuld, were not forgotten by Cynophane or her people. Nor were the efforts of Clan Battlehammer and King Brunner. Many in the region blamed Brunner now for signing the treaty that had allowed the Kingdom of Many Arrows to gain a hold on the land, but Cynophane was not among that group. Nay, she remembered that long-ago time, and had not forgotten the pressures that had forced Brunner's decision, as, apparently, so many of the human kings of the region had done. To her it all seemed a convenient rewriting of history to assign blame, that Sundabar and Silvery Moon and all the others needn't take any of the blame upon themselves. Cynophane's clan was guilty of the same, she supposed. But Cynophane knew better. And she understood that the kingdoms of Lorwar would now stand together, or surely they would all fall. The prospects of living forevermore under the shadow of Dark Arrow Keep did not sit well with the elf. Not at all.
Wulfgar squinted against the sudden torchlight, and the sting of the flame served as a reminder to him of how long it had been, 10 days, since he'd seen any substantial light. He was ready to attack, or thought he was, but the light shocked and slowed him. He would not be the first to strike, but he did note, in the first moment of the light, that orcs had moved around him on both flanks. He had to act quickly, or he would find spears thrusting in at him from too many angles to block. But the orc behind him and to the left gasped and went tumbling back in front of him, slamming into the next in line. And then the orc behind him to the right similarly gurgled, and it too went tumbling. The other orcs roared in protest and lifted their spears. Wulfgar, still barely able to see, raised Aegis Fang defensively. The orcs let fly, but they weren't aiming for him, he realized, as the missile flew past him and back the way he had come. Regis! He heard his halfling friend cry out, then heard the click of a hand crossbow, and the orc directly in front of Wulfgar shrieked in pain and stumbled backward. The two on the floor struggled against unyielding garrots. The remaining three howled and started their charge. Out to the left went Aegis Fang, stabbing like a spear, the mithril head of the warhammer connecting on the side of the orc's face and driving it hard into the wall. Wulfgar jabbed the weapon's handle out in front of the leading orc on that side, bracing the butt of the weapon against the wall and halting the orc's progress. Wulfgar leaped in against the brute, pressing it into the wall and turning the angle of his warhammer. He drove out to his left, the hammer's head cracking under the jaw of the last of the orcs, and the brute went flying back. Around went Wulfgar in a sudden spin, and he let fly the warhammer as he came around, the weapon spinning into that same orc and driving it away. Still turning, Wulfgar fell against the orc he had pinned into the wall. He felt a sting in his belly, the bite of a knife. He grabbed the orc by the front of its tunic and spun, hoisting the creature and hurling it across the corridor to slam into the wall. Wulfgar's hand went reflexively to his belly and came back covered in blood. He looked to the two orcs choking on the floor, hideous, leering specters over their shoulders, tugging the garrots. One went still, the other was soon to follow. He glanced at the first orc he had struck, dazed and down on one knee. He called Aegis Fang back to his hand and finished the beast with a heavy chop. Turning, he saw the sudden charge of another orc, the beast's spear leveled for Wulfgar's belly. Off flew Aegis Fang, the hammer exploding into the chest of the orc, the same orc Regis had shot in the face. The stubborn fool came on groggily with a dart in its cheek and then flew back into the darkness. Wulfgar heard Regis whimper behind him, and the sound spurred the barbarian on in rage. He turned and kicked out with all his strength, driving his foot into the throat of the slumping orc he had thrown into the wall. At his call, Aegis Fang returned, but he didn't put it to use again. Instead, he turned and rushed to his friend. Regis was standing, bent over slightly at the waist, so that the butt of the spear that was embedded in his chest was set upon the ground. He said not a word as Wulfgar approached, but gave Wulfgar a look that expressed remorse, as if he was sorry he had failed his friend. "We have to move," Wulfgar said. The barbarian grabbed the spear shaft gently, but even that slight touch had Regis trembling in pain. Inspecting the wound, Wulfgar knew that he could not extract it. Surely he'd take half of Regis's lung with it if he tried. He had set Aegis Fang on the ground and grasped the staff in both hands.
"No choice, my friend," he said to Regis. "Brace, I beg."
Regis tensed up and clenched his teeth. The knuckles on Wulfgar's left hand, the hand gripping the shaft right by the entry point, whitened as the mighty Wulfgar locked his grip. The muscles in Wolfgar's neck and along his arms corded then as he began his determined press. His hands were barely 5 fingers' breadths apart, giving him little room to bend the shaft, and it seemed impossible that a man could break the thick wood with only that small gap between his hands. But Wulfgar had made his reputation in both lifetimes on doing things that seemed impossible for a mortal man. His muscles corded more distinctly. He sucked in his breath.
"Prepare," he warned his little friend through clenched teeth,
and Regis began to make a sound that seemed half whimper and half determined growl.
Wulfgar too growled and sucked in his breath again, and with a sudden jerk he twisted his right hand down with tremendous force while keeping his bracing left hand level. The spear snapped, Regis swooned, and Wulfgar caught him before he hit the floor. For a moment he thought the halfling might be dead, so still did Regis lie in his arms. It wasn't until the halfling snored that Wulfgar was sure he was alive.
"What?"
Wulfgar asked quietly, as soon as the absurd notion hit him. At around that time, another missile soared in from the darkness behind them. Not the second, but the third missile to strike Regis in that fight, Wulfgar realized when the small hand crossbow dart hit the halfling's shoulder. Wulfgar staggered backward, rising to his full height. He threw Regis over his left shoulder, grabbed up Aegis Fang in his right hand, and hurled it down the hallway at the dark elves he knew to be there. He spun around and fled, passing only to gather up the torch in his free hand as he passed it. He hated the idea of carrying such a beacon, but without it he could not hope to press on. He kept his arm locked around the bouncing Regis, holding him in place, but freed up his hand to transfer the torch so he could recall his warhammer with his right hand. As soon as Aegis Fang appeared, Wulfgar wheeled and sent it spinning off into the darkness behind him yet again, and then again over and over, scrambling as fast as he could and trying to hold back the drow. To his relief, the corridor split a short distance later, then spiderwebbed into a myriad of side tunnels. Better still, these walls were lined with some quartz or mica or some other shiny mineral, and the torchlight bounced every which way. There was no method to the barbarian's chosen course. He did not slow long enough to consider one. He just went on, turning at almost every junction, determined to not allow enough of a tunnel behind him for one of those sleeping darts to reach out and take him down. Regis was just beginning to stir when Wulfgar plodded on softer ground, on some light-colored, powdery soil that he did not know.
"Welcome back," he whispered to the halfling,
and was about to add the suggestion that Regis stay very quiet when the ground gave out beneath him. They were sliding, not tumbling, riding the powdery soil down to a lower level. The torch sparkled off a million reflective surfaces. They were in a vast cavern, columned with stalagmites and stalactites, but only for a moment. He rolled over as he slid and had to abandon both the torch and Regis, or risk rolling right atop the halfling, perhaps driving the spearhead in deeper. He came to a stop against the side of a stalagmite, Regis sliding into him with a groan and the torch disappearing under a sandpile on the floor. Then there was only blackness and no sound except the whimpering of Regis beside him. Gradually, Wulfgar's eyes adjusted enough for him to make out general shapes. There were illuminating plants in here, though sparse in number. He couldn't make out Regis on the ground, so he gingerly felt around to gauge the halfling's position before gently lifting him once more. He could see the shadows of the stalagmites and stalactites, though, just barely, and so he went on. They had fallen a long way, but not long enough, not with dark elves on their trail. Wulfgar plodded through, ankle deep in the soft sand. Gradually his eyes grew more accustomed, and gradually the ground firmed up once more, and Wulfgar gained speed and confidence. He knew he was nearing the edge of the cavern, knew that a tunnel lay ahead, and one with enough illumination for him to continue along, it seemed. But not enough illumination to reveal to Wulfgar that the lip of the tunnel entrance was about a hand's breadth too low for him to run under it while standing upright. He felt the hot explosion as his forehead smashed into the stone. He felt his legs running out in front of him, felt himself falling backward. He even heard Regis cry out in surprise and fear. Somewhere, Wulfgar was conscious of all of that. But he was falling, falling, far, far away.